Welcome back to Finding the Edge podcast. I'm Garrett Boyum, joined with Robert Fry.
And today we have on Julian Gonzalez, a hitting instructor with a little bit of ecological dynamic flair to his teachings.
I'm super excited to have Julian on. I met Julian back when I was visiting the Data Cage, and he was working there with Tim Gibbons, otherwise known as Line Drive Pro. And if you don't follow Tim Gibbons at Line Drive Pro, check him out on Twitter or Instagram. He's got some great, great hitting videos. Also, you should check out both Julian and Tim were both on Chad Longworth's podcast. And you should definitely, if you like what you hear here on this podcast with Julian, make sure to go over and check out Chad's podcast. Chad's got lots of good stuff. If you're not following the Longworth podcast, make sure to get on it. Anyways, super excited to have Julian on here. He's been running wild with these ecological ideas, plus some of the other stuff that we've talked about over the years and here on this podcast about breathing, the importance of breathing, the mental side of the game, and all sorts of other stuff. Robert, what else am I missing here that we talked about today with Julian?
Yeah, we talked about a lot, as you already mentioned, mental side, ecological dynamics. We talked about hitting environments, types of teaching and education. We talked a bit about softball versus baseball and understanding like the value of a ground ball. In when it comes to hitting in some sort of way, comparing softball to baseball. And then we talk about like utilizing video. And then we also talked about a bit about styles of learning. And then lastly, we did talk about a bit, again, more of the mental side again, but we talked a bit about failing and creating those environments that allow players to fail so they can succeed later on.
Yeah, absolutely. Additionally, too, when it came to the softball swing that we were discussing, is the softball swing different than a baseball swing? And because Julian also has a background working with softball. So again, we, in true ecological form, we were all over the place in a non-linear way. So hope you guys enjoy today's podcast with Julian Gonzalez. So Julian, super excited to have you on. Been wanting to have you on for a little bit too, especially since I've met you in Florida way back when, and then you've been really interested in EcoD, and it's been cool to see some of the stuff that you've been doing with some of the ideas. So I wanted to have you on to kind of explore that more with you. Do you want to give some kind of background on yourself? You know, kind of where you're at, what you're doing currently, and then we'll go from there.
Yes, sir. Yeah. So currently I am coaching at Trinity Christian Academy in Jacksonville, Florida. We're a private school, so we got middle school all the way to high school. So I kind of oversee all the hitting. So try to for sure keep the same thing for all the guys, even if they're younger, just try to change up different bat sizes and stuff like that. Coaching travel ball. It's about to finish up here with the Florida Burn. Got a 15U, so they're freshmen, 2025s, and then doing hitting sessions on the side. And then currently working on some stuff for a new opportunity. But yeah, kind of been coaching here and there. So I met, like Garrett said, I think maybe like 3 years ago or so at the Data Cage. Shout out to Mark Spencer and Tip Gibbons, who's the AAA hitting coach for the Orioles. And yeah, just hit it off with Garrett right away there. And that's how we are here now. Coached college softball for 2.5 years, coached high school softball for a year. Prior to being back in high school now, baseball, I was coaching high school baseball for a year at my high school back in Tampa at Mitchell. So feels like it's been forever, but overall, I think it's only been like 7 years, 6 years coaching as a whole. But I feel like I've been doing this for ages.
It's funny you bring up the Data Cage and Mark, because you guys got to use a flight scope there, or at least I know Mark had a flight scope at the time. So
yeah,
that's another cool connection. Did you actually get to use the flight scope much?
Yes. Yeah. So we had two cages, if you remember, and usually we were split. So Tim was usually in the one with the flight scope. And then towards the end, we ended up getting Rapsodo. and that was in the other cage. But Flight Scope was awesome. I loved it. Just being able to have the exit velocity and the launch angle, and had the distance as well on there. So it was sweet just seeing it and the kids having a visual. Just when you're in a cage, a lot of times kids just get bored. So just having that visual there with the technology with Flight Scope was sweet for the kids to have and just helping them and learn.
Were you able to ever get any of the data off of it and then use that and look at that at all?
Yeah, every once in a while, we didn't get really deep into it. At the end, Mark started going, that's what he's doing a lot now, started going to colleges and to other high schools around the area and would give them their data back. So it was cool seeing some, like when I went to the data cage after I left UNF, we went to UNF and we gave them the data, and just seeing the softball data was pretty cool. Can go down a rabbit hole with the rise ball and if it actually rises or not, but just seeing the proof of it there that the rise ball doesn't actually rise was like, oh snap, all right. So just seeing the feedback and seeing how Flight Scope and any technology can just kind of help with any biases that people may have.
So to start with softball, you coach softball. What are the similarities and differences that you've, you know, seen from working with softball to baseball, and what, if any, transfer have you found between the two?
Yeah. So the biggest thing difference wise, I say, would be just coaching. And I think it has evolved a lot. I mean, seeing like Carlton Salters at UTSA, like he's killing it out there. Couple other guys, Evan Rochelle, I think I pronounced his last name wrong, but he's back in baseball now. But those guys really bringing their baseball background into softball, and like, hey, there's not much of a difference in the swing. Yes, the distance is different. Softball is 43 feet and how close it is, and the game's way faster. But a lot of coaches, say even now currently, but for sure 5-6 years ago or so, were very much so, even if you're a power hitter, like, all right, we're going to hit the ball on the ground and kind of just see what happens and make some errors. The fields are shorter. The bases are shorter. So let's just try to hit the ball on the ground. So I wasn't there long enough to really, I helped out with the hitting side of stuff. But just seeing how much softball has evolved recently has been super awesome. And just seeing guys like Carlton at the front of it leading the way. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like having the data back to, like you said, with Flight Scope, I mean, the balls were still coming down negative. It wasn't as much as a mound, of course, but it was still coming down at a negative descent. So, I mean, like always still trying to swing through the ball, want to hit through and up a little bit. So seeing the similarities in that and just how go about stuff. End of the day, the swing's the swing. So your body's all moving the same in baseball or softball. So yeah.
What's one thing that baseball coaches underappreciate about softball?
Ooh. Huh, good question.
Cuz one thing you mentioned was the game is a lot faster.
Yeah.
And so I sometimes get the sense that maybe baseball coaches or just baseball people somewhat see the game as easier, it being softball.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's always a great debate, honestly. Just like even now with my high school kids, they know a bunch of the softball players are like, oh, we'd take them yard. The fields are 220. And it's like, dude, it's not that easy, man. Like, it's like, oh, well, they got these light bats and the ball's so big. I was like, yeah, it's still very, very difficult. Like, it doesn't make it easier. So, yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. Follow up to that follow up. Now in softball, there's a lot of advantage to kind of that slap hitting concept where you just kind of slap it, hit it on the ground. So my question to you is, do softball people within softball overvalue a ground ball, or do people in baseball undervalue a ground ball?
Ooh, I think in softball they overvalue it. Once again, shout out to Carlton. He's done a really good job with his slap hitters that he does have, to where he's kind of, and I love because he posts everything. So he's kind of transformed a lot of the slappers that he's had to where, like you said, is like, oh, slap, slap, slap. And there's like four different types of slap, like power slap, like slaps to the just going like regular slap, slap buns, like there's everything, right? But Carlton has really tried to get his hitters to have all of those and have all those tools in the belt, but really trying to get those slappers to be able to still drive the ball in the air, which now, I mean, able to be running out of the box and put the ball in the air, like now you're probably turning a single into a double or a double into a triple as opposed just trying to hit a ground ball when you're slapping and try to aim, where they try to aim usually closer to home plate so they get a higher bounce and just get a single out of it. And now trying to incorporate some more ball in the air, some more ball flight to get some extra base hits and not just singles.
So basically he's creating a complete adaptable dexterous hitter.
Yes.
That's freaking awesome. Had to get some EcoD language in there. But I guess so what's kind of been your experience working with these sort of concepts, ecological dynamics, kind of what's been your first kind of foray into it?
Yeah, so I think for sure. I remember when we had met, I just started reading Constraints-Led Approach, the book. And I remember talking to you about it and picking your brain and then just continue to read the book and finishing the book and be like, all right, just in my eyes and still, I mean, that's how I still coach, how we can create these environments and challenge hitters with bats, different balls, whether it's different angles, throwing overhand or machine, whatever it is, and challenging them without us having to say so much. And I know that for some people that's like, oh, well, you still got to coach. And we're still coaching in those environments. It's not like we're just here, do this and figure it out by yourself, which that is part of it for sure. But getting into that and seeing it work firsthand at the data cage and Chad Longworth bringing in his like weighted bats that he had and starting to use those and just seeing how it just helped clean stuff up without being overly mechanical with them. And now biggest thing with me talking to my hitters all the time is I don't want you guys to become robotic. So creating these environments with these constraints-led approach and these different environments we're creating with different bats and different body positions, whatever it might be, and making them athletic and not robots.
I think that's a really great point. You know, cause you talked about, you know, people are like, well, you still have to coach them. And I would agree with that, but from an ecological approach, we're mostly coaching from the standpoint of educating their attention, to certain types of information, or towards something, or, re-educating or, educating their intention. So what is their intention during the session? What are they focusing on?
Yeah,
I think that's much more how we try to approach it than telling them this is here. This is how you have to move in order to solve this problem.
Yes, you nailed it. I love it because like it's cool and just seeing the past 3 years now being at Trinity, and I mean we've brought different things in. Jonathan Murphy, he's played minor league baseball for a couple of years, and it was different for the kids. So year three now, like last week we were in the cage and I was hitting with a couple of our seniors and one of them was like, hey, like, and he started coaching him and I didn't have to say anything. And it's just sweet just what the environment does. Now the kids are coaching each other rather than us having to say something every 2 seconds, which was we really try hard and we don't do. But it's sweet just seeing how those environments, now they're learning together and I'm learning with them alongside them. And I'm not harping at them every 2 seconds. And like you said, what's your focus? And that's why I love being with high schoolers too, because I mean, they're so young and it's like, all right, I'm hitting. They step out and they're talking about their girlfriends or about what happened in school. So just that focus with the environment you're creating, like if you're not locked in and have a intention, have a specific focus, then you're not going to get anything out of it.
I think one of the things too, is that us as coaches, we are supposed to be facilitators. So what you're describing there is like we are facilitating the practice environment that allows the athlete to flourish. And so oftentimes what we're doing is simply either setting the environment or manipulating things within the environment to help shape the behavior that we're looking for them to have, or to help them actually better connect to the problem. And so that, to me, is what the big difference is between kind of a traditional model versus an ecological approach, is we're much more focused on helping the athlete better connect to the information in the environment and being more highly attuned or sensitive to that information, instead of focusing on, say, their mechanics and making sure that they're moving in a specific way or the correct way. And so I think for me, there's a lot more focus on them getting reps, so to speak. Although for me personally, it's not necessarily going to look like guys getting, you know, 300 swings a day or something like that. It might look like, you know, 100 or 150 or even 75 or something much lower, but it's much more focused on them having a lot of high quality reps.
Yes.
And really too, it's also about thinking about how representative is the task that I am giving them as well.
Yes, 100%. I love that, because like that's how we try to break up our cage sessions, or like when we're hitting in the cage that day. All right, I try to focus on having a cage that's going to be replicative of the game. So whether it's, and I know, get down a rabbit hole, but machines, and we use the machines quite a bit. Just challenging them with the velocity aspect of it, or whether it's one of the coaches throwing overhand and throwing mixed BP, and then having a cage of barrel accuracy. So whether it's plyo balls or whether it's tennis balls or wiffle balls with PVCs. All right, well, you got to barrel the ball up in the game. So like you said, making it as game-like as possible, and then having some type of timing. So once again, whether it's three plate or whether it's mixed BP or whatever it is, and trying to make the cages as game-like as possible. And it's not like, all right, just hit off the tee. And like you said, just getting your quantity instead of your quality swings in. It's like, oh, I hit off the tee 600 times today. I got 600 balls off the tee. I'm ready. And it's like, no, you're not. You probably got worse from it now. So that's why one shout out to you guys. Just love the conversations you guys have and learn so much from you guys doing how am I going to challenge myself to challenge my kids.
And to bank off that, how do the kids feel about going through those representative environment plus that bio ball, you know, that barrel accuracy or whatever type of constraints you have?
Well, and two, right, the challenging environments. We've talked with Caleb a little bit about that.
Yeah.
It can be hard to have guys buy into creating an environment where there may be a lower success rate.
Yep.
So yeah, how do you get that buy-in?
Yeah, so once again, being year three, our first year being there, especially with the machines, they were like, we hate this, don't want to do this, and they're more bought in with that. And then with the barrel accuracy stuff, especially like the plyo balls, with the wiffle balls, you don't barrel them up, you see the funky spin, and it's like, all right, well, I suck, or I'm failing, or whatever. And just pouring into them and reminding them like, hey, we want you to fail. It's okay to fail. Because if you don't fail, then one, when you do start failing, because it's baseball, it's going to happen, then how are you going to know to make an adjustment, or what your adjustments specifically are? So just challenging them and reminding them that. And now that it's year three, they're bought in and understand for sure. But the first couple of years, it was difficult. Like they were like, God, do we have to use the machine today? Or, oh, we really have to do this and do that. But I think them seeing the fruit now, year three, some seniors, one of our other guys, shout out to them, just a couple of guys just signed college scholarships. So just seeing the hard work they've put in through these environments, that it's not just, oh, Coach Julian and Murph just want to do this because they're the coaches and they're saying this. Like, no, we have a reasoning behind it. And I think them seeing the success, not in the cage, of course, because they are failing, but seeing it on the field has been like, all right, like there is a why behind this. But Garrett, I think you and I, when we talked last month, talked about how you don't want to have too much failure as well, where they're just failing all the time, excuse me, because now they're just, now the mental side comes in. Now they're just defeated. They don't want to do this anymore. So you do have to have a mixture of having some feel good, BP or whatever it may be, or some fun stuff which you try to do on the field with like first and third scrimmages and coach pitch and stuff like that, to where you want to have a good balance of it, and you don't just want to overload them with failure, 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 and then they're like, oh crap, this sucks, well, I don't want to do this anymore.
What is one thing that you've kind of knew that you've adopted, that you've seen, that you or have been looking into, that you found surprising as it relates to helping your athletes out?
I think just language, I guess, just how I go about talking to the guys about certain things. Like with some hitters, I might have to say one specific word or some other stuff, and with another player, something different. So I feel like that, and just with the hit, yeah, I feel like with that right now.
What, if anything else, like when it comes to hitting environments, do you really like to have in there and present?
Yeah, so I know always different types of bats, long bat, short bat, overload, underload, different balls, machine, coach pitch. I feel like those are always like the key things that I have in there, in every cage, or at least in one of the cages with the guys, are like the key stuff that we have. And then since we don't have any technology, just the way that I had set up the cages, we, I put hula hoops up in the cages at different angles. So shout out to Iowa Baseball. They have, through their student managers, like one of the PowerPoints, I think, or Excel. And they like made some algorithm that you can just type in how long your cage is and stuff. And you just type everything in, and then it spits out where you should put whatever you're going to hang from it. So that helped out so much, because I'm not the best math person out there. So I got hula hoops set up from 10, 50, we got 15, 10, and then 8 degrees, which is like at our cage, it's 75 feet long, and it's all the way at the back of the cage, like at the top. So me and Murph have talked about it, and just looking at like Baseball Savant, and all right, these are professional guys and they are way bigger than our guys, physically. So what would be an ideal like launch angle for our kids to be focusing on? So like for each hitter, like our first baseman's a tank country boy, like, all right, you can live at the 15 degrees for sure. But some of our other guys is like, all right, you guys live like 10 to 8. So just having those, once again, just those external focuses for them, so they're not just hitting. And a lot of times with these high schoolers, they feel like they barreled one up, and it's like, hey man, sorry, but you don't got that much juice. That's a pop fly. You got to live a little bit lower. So having those external goals for them, to once again, having that intention and that focus to something outside of themselves.
I love that, especially when it comes to trying to a little bit recreate the field a little bit and give them a feel for, you know, hey, where is that pitch going to be, or that hit going to be going? And two, because I've been thinking about that, how do I recreate, you know, different openings in the field, or where players are positioned within the cage? And so for me, that's probably been the best alternative, is to either have something like hula hoops or the lines in the cage. So I like that. Where was that again?
I have to send it to you. I found it through Robin Lund. He's the pitching coach at Iowa. I think he had tweeted it once, and I like bookmarked it just because, like, all right, I'm going to use this one day, and then I like found it. But yeah, I'll have to send it to you guys on Twitter.
No, that sounds perfect. One last question regarding that. Do you, if at all, incorporate video into your atmosphere?
Yeah, so our guys mostly during, so Murph does it quite a bit during the cages, like if he's trying to show a kid a specific, like something specific. I do every once in a while, mostly I do because my kids ask during our scrimmages or during our fall games. Our kids are like, hey, Coach Julian, can you video my at bats? So during games, I usually do it. And I rather do it in game so they can see their in-game stuff, as to oppose whether it's machine, I know for some kids, just timing wise and the machine's going to be difficult. So seeing it as game-like as possible, their swing, and it's not off of front flips or something, or off the tee. So they're seeing something more replicative of the game. So actually during our scrimmages is when I'll take video and then send it to them or show them during the half inning or whatever it may be. But I'd say I do like video. Like, I don't want to live or die by it, 'cause then I don't want the kids to be paralyzed by it and just be, all right, overload. Every time I hit, I have to have video, or I have to look at this, or I have to do that. So like every once in a while, for sure, like, hey, here's your video. Or if they ask, like, I'll do it whenever they ask.
Yeah. And you kind of mentioned it a little bit too, in terms of like rather having in-game video than, say, you know, off a machine video. My question regarding that is, you know, how do you feel if someone were to have more like practice video than in-game video? How would those tables be turned in terms of, you know, how a hitter can improve?
So like how practice video versus game video?
Yes.
And like the good and bad of it, I guess, or?
Yeah, more or less.
And then too, like, how would you utilize the practice video if you didn't have as much game video to work with a player?
Yeah, so I guess with the practice video, I mean, I'll still look into it. Like with the guys that I hit individually with, like they'll send me video cage or whatever it is. And I'll still take into account for sure. Hopefully it's with a moving ball. And take into account just movement or setup. And I try more to look at the setup stuff. So like if I'm looking at their practice video, that's what we have for right now. I'm more of a guy, I guess, that looks at the setup and look at, all right, what are you doing from the start, instead of going through like every second of the video. And then I'm like, well, you did this wrong in the middle of your swing. And it's like, all right, why did that happen in the middle of a swing? Might be starting with your hands too low or too high. So I guess overall with the video, to answer your question, I would look at the practice video, but I like to look at the setup as a whole though, with everything, instead of like looking at every second of everything and then now becoming a robot. It's like, well, you got to do this during this half of your swing and this during this phase and do this during this. So.
To transition a little bit, one of the other things that I think we've kind of talked a little bit about is the mental side of the game and also like arousal regulation. And for me personally, why that's interesting is from an ecological approach or a constraint led approach, oftentimes we look at the three different kind of or constraints, you know. So you have the task constraint, the environmental constraint, and the organismic or individual constraints. And I very much see the mental side of the game and arousal regulation as relating to the individual or the constraints that are on the individual. And I know this is something that we both kind of looked into, and I see this as being something that a lot of coaches think about, but they don't think about how does this integrate within our practice design and the practice activities that we design for our athletes. So I'm kind of curious at, you know, the stuff that you have done with that, and how have you tried to integrate that into your practice design?
Yeah, so like you said, we've talked about it last time we had spoken. I think I brought up with high school, it's so much more difficult, just the amount of kids. You have like 40 kids out there, being middle school to high school. So it's a little more difficult talking about the breathing aspect of stuff, talking about that. We get to talk a lot about the mental side, but just the breathing aspect. So when I get to do my hitting sessions individually, whether it's one kid or two kids, usually with all my new kids, I try to start out with some type of breathing technique. And I bring up why, like you said, like individually, everybody, like I always bring up the idea of, all right, runner on second and third, you're down by a run, bottom of the inning right here, base hit wins the game. Like thinking, all right, how's our heart rate going to be? So, all right, how are you going to slow down your heart rate? You got to be able to breathe and slow your heart rate down. So I'm like, you're either going to be super pumped and be like, all right, I want to be in this moment. And your heart rate might be pumping too high because you're just super jittery, or you're scared and you're like, oh man, I really don't want to be in this situation. Your heart rate's going super fast. So how are you able to slow your heart rate down and be in the moment, which is the biggest thing? How can I be in the moment right now and not worry about, well, if I do this, now we're going to win the game. If I don't do this, we're going to lose and it's going to be because of me. So I really try to do some type of breathing exercises with my individual lessons and bringing up, hey, this is why breathing is important. And I always ask them, hey, what's your routine like? And they go through their routine. I was like, hey, notice you don't have breathing in your routine. You just tap the plate, fix your batting gloves. That's all great because it's going to allow you to slow the game down. But I want you to try to incorporate some type of breathing wherever in your routine that's going to fit well.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think I took from Brian Kane this past year was the idea of when, what's important now.
Yep.
I actually liked it, like what's important right now,
yeah.
Which doesn't sound as good as when. Learn is not as good of a little moniker, but I think for me, that's what I want guys to focus on. Hey, how can you be present here in this moment, fully mm-hmm. connected to the information that's going on right in front of you. But what's interesting too with that, especially when we're talking about hitting, is really that needs to come into full focus when you got both feet in the box and you're looking at the pitcher and he's getting ready to deliver the pitch. That's when you need to be fully present.
Yeah.
And you know, you can think a little bit more when, you know, you have one foot out of the box and in between pitches.
Yeah.
But once you step into that box, you got to be fully present.
Yeah. I love that. So one of the things that I wrote down, so I remember, is like a couple books that I've read. First one is The Mental Keys to Hitting by H.A. Dorfman. That one's fantastic. And shout out to Benny Craig, Feel Good Hitting on Twitter. He's the one that kind of like got me into all the breathing stuff and kind of went down a rabbit hole during COVID. But The Mental Keys to Hitting is huge. And H.A. talks about that in there, how when you have one foot out the box, like you just mentioned, you can think a little bit, all right, whatever your goal or whatever your focus is right now, your adjustment. But once you step in the box, like you said, if you're thinking of anything, H.A. always said you should think about be easy, see the ball. Sean Casey talks about it all the time too in some of his videos, like be easy, hit the ball hard, be easy, right center gap, whatever it is. But it should never be, all right, I'm gonna do this with my feet and do this with my hand, because you're gonna be toast at this point. Like the ball's gonna be past you. So like you said, think outside the box. Once you're in the box, I should be present in the moment. Ryan Harrison, who does all the vision stuff, slow the game down, he says, if you think, you stink, is what he says. And I kind of tell my kids that all the time. Hey, you're in the box and you're thinking, you stink. You're gonna. I don't care how nice of a swing you think you may have, you're gonna fail. So just how can I incorporate that and challenge the kids mentally with the breathing aspect of it? But then mentally, like you brought up, just there's so much mentally that goes on within baseball with the failure, self-coaching, talks about it in the book, and kids telling themselves, I can't do this, can't do that. And we challenge our kids to say, hey, that's not part of our vocabulary. Like, we will never say we can't. Say, hey, I will do this. We should do this. So now just mentally, I'm in a better place as to oppose, oh, I can't do this. Or, hey, don't swing at this pitch. Hey, don't think about a white horse. Like, what are you going to think about the white horse? So always having those positives. Hey, I will do this at bat. I can do this. We should do this. And just the mental side of it is just absolutely huge, and something that I don't think as hitting coaches we bring into our tool belt enough, and the breathing aspect of it as well, like we were talking about and you said.
Well, and two, this kind of goes to this idea, you know, you think you stink. It's not like that's something that coaches haven't known for a really long time.
Correct.
And what I find interesting is there has been some pushback on this idea of self-organization and creating an environment where the athlete can find their way to the solution, or just, you know, understanding how the constraints shape the movement. and the system self-organizes to meet those constraints. And there's been a lot of pushback to this idea or just an ecological approach, yet it really fits well with things that coaches have intuitively understood for a very long time. And so that's one of the things that I'd like, you know, people to know and understand about an ecological approach is that it actually squares well with a lot of the intuitive stuff that's out there. And two, I think this kind of goes to back to this thing of understanding that the mental side of the game or the kind of the internal stuff that's going on inside has a big influence on shaping the movement and how you're interacting with the problem. So your swing, essentially, you know, based upon how you're breathing or your heart rate or your mental state, all is going to shape your ability to hit the ball and whether or how your movement, whether it's going to be smooth, fluid, rigid, robotic, etc. You know, whether you're, you know, hit all those mechanical checkpoints, that's all going to be influenced by your mental state, you know, your state of arousal, etc. And so that's why, to me, this is a very easy way to begin to actually clean up an athlete's movement is simply by addressing the mental side of the game, their arousal regulation, their breathing. Do you want to touch briefly or explain, you know, your understanding of what arousal regulation is? I think it's kind of intuitive, but what does that actually encompass when we're actually talking about arousal regulation?
Oof, that's a good question. Yeah, you tell if you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is something that in my sports psych class, I tried to give a presentation on arousal regulation, and I had a hard time describing what it is because it encompasses a lot of things. Like it encompasses your, you know, in a way, it's your state of being. Like, are you relaxed, chilled out? To are you like really hyped up? Excited, afraid, etc. And then two, there's also this notion of, you know, is your mental state coherent or incoherent? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that has a big influence on our arousal state and two, our coherence and our ability to kind of think clearly has to do with our heart rate. And one of the biggest ways to influence our heart rate is through breathing. And so that's why, to me, one of the simplest tools we could use is breathing. But here's the thing with breathing, as I understand it, when it comes to coherence and changing your heart rate, one breath isn't necessarily going to change your physiological state necessarily. I do think it helps because, again, I think from a mental side of things, if you believe that this is going to relax you, it's going to relax you. You know, like automatically the system is going to start to relax. That's where, you know, you see somebody take a deep breath in, you know, like, and their chest rises, their shoulder rises, and then it drops down. That is more of a embodied kind of symbol, you know, to like that symbolizes relaxation, even though the breath you took was an awful breath. Like that, it defies all good breath mechanics. Like you should breathe into your belly or your diaphragm and, you know, the upper half and the shoulder shouldn't move and all that sort of stuff. But simply that movement though, that feels like, oh, you can feel the tension. And then you let your shoulders fall and then you feel the tension releasing. That in and of itself is relaxing. But if we want to have something that is more robust and actually change the physiology underneath, then we actually need to start thinking about our breathing. And so for me, what I have found to actually do that, because one of the things, and I know Julian, you've talked about this, is doing tempoed breathing. You know, having some, whatever, if you want to get into a more coherent state, your breathing needs to be regular or tempoed. And so it doesn't matter what that tempo is, whether, you know, it's on a one count in and a two count out, it doesn't matter just as long as it's consistent. That's the big thing. And so for me, I played around with like, all right, do we tell guys to count in their minds? But how do you know what the right tempo is? Because you know, if they're feeling stressed, they might not feel like they have time to do a four count, you know, to do, you know, a box breathing, you know, four in, yep, hold for, yeah, four, out for four, hold for four. But it's like, that's 16 seconds, you know, that feels like a lot of time. And then too, if you begin to think about it, if we're talking about a pitcher on average, the pitch is, you know, turned around and thrown again in what, about like 20 to 30 seconds on the long end, but about 20-ish seconds. So, I mean, you only did one cycle, you know, that's not enough to get it changed. And so for me, where I have moved to is this idea of a mantra and taking, you know, two words back to what you were talking about before, Julian, taking two words, you know, whether I can't remember the two that you had, given,
for see the ball, be easy.
Yeah. Like, yeah, you know, smooth and easy, you know, like, and have like smooth be the in-breath and easy being the out-breath. That is way easier for somebody to begin to get their breathing to be rhythmical and consistent by tying it to those two words that you need to do to regulate your arousal. And then, you know, secondarily, when we're talking about arousal regulation, we need to have awareness of what our current arousal state is. Are we too amped up? Are we actually too relaxed? You know, this is this whole notion when coaches, you know, scream at players, you need to wake up. I mean, that's the idea. You're just way too relaxed. Like you're not checked in. And so becoming aware of where your current state of being is will dictate what words are going to be most beneficial for you. And that's why for me, it's not about giving you two words I got out of a book, but rather you as the athlete need to be able to assess where you're at and figure out what words are going to resonate most with you and use those two words.
Yeah. And like you said, I think we had talked about this, like, this is a question. I mean, I don't have the answers, but if a guy is too calmed down, like as an athlete yourself, as an athlete or as a coach, like how, as the coach, do you get them to get pumped up? Or as an athlete, like what do you have to do to get your heart rate a little bit pumped up for the certain situation or whatever it may be?
Well, I mean, this goes back to what we had talked about before, education of attention. So I'm going to educate your attention to the fact that your arousal level is way too low and you need to wake up. And then two, then from there, educate their intention. So that education of their attention to, you know, their current arousal state, if they're not aware of it. And then maybe I might help them out with their intention, but they might be able to then, because now they're aware of their current arousal state, then re-educate their intention. And so that's how I would at least think you should approach that, is first going through education of attention and then intention, or vice versa.
That's good.
You know, to build off of this further, I look at this in terms of flow states. You know, like the mental side and all this sort of stuff, being fully present, that helps get you into a flow state. And so that's why for me, it's like this stuff is really important. So I guess to throw it out there generally, and I'll throw kind of my thoughts in there afterwards, like how do we integrate this instead of having it just be like this thing that we do separate, you know, like, hey, well, all right, now we're going to do some mental skills type, yeah, of a thing, or like breathing or relaxation or visualization, instead of like having that being a segment at the beginning of practice, or, you know, on a separate day, when you're in a classroom and having a classroom session, how do we bring this to the field and actually integrate it into our practice?
So I was thinking about this as you were talking about just the arousal aspect of it. And that's why I do love the ecological or the constraints-led approach and making it challenging, because now the failure is happening. So as the failure is happening, now the mental side's happening in your head. And I was like, crap, all right, well, I just failed now. And in the game, you're going to fail. So how are you going to respond back? So making those environments in the cages, or if you're able to hit on the field often, not just making it, and once again, finding that balance, but making it as game-like as possible, like you said. And like you said, how are we able to integrate this? Making it as game-like as possible. Because if not, then when the game happens and they've never failed before, they've never gotten their heart rate to a specific point, then like just gonna see what happens. One thing that I like to do, and it's cool because the past couple weeks, a couple of my kids have brought it up. Hey, can we do this more? I stole it from Pete Lordston, Success Leaves Clues. And he's back in JUCO in Iowa. And one of the things that he had posted, I think it was for last season, he had like these situations printed out on a piece of paper, and the kids would just like grab out a number from the hat. And he actually had it typed out on the computer. I had written it down on a paper for my kids. And you pick out a number and you read out the piece of paper. It has a situation. So like, for instance, they pick one out and has like runner on first, 1-1 count, bottom of the fifth inning, down by two runs or whatever it may be. And I tell the kids, hey, what's your approach right now? What are you trying to do? And then if it's a certain count, I'm like, all right, hey, this is the situation. Do it off the machine or coach pitch, whichever one that day. And then I tell them, and this is something I try to incorporate, make it as game-like as possible. So go through your routine. Because so many times in the cage, once again, kids are just swing, swing, swing. It's like, hey, after each swing, go through your routine. Make it as game-like as possible. But that's one way that I've tried to get those arousals and those game situations to where now they have this mindset of, all right, there's a runner on first. It's a 1-1 count. What do I have to do in this situation? And getting just the mind and the heart rate and like trying to make it as game-like as possible, getting those situations and, like you said, that arousal going and see how they respond.
And
what you got, Robert?
How does using that those kind of cards to make it simplistic, how has that changed your kids with hitting, and how has that changed? I don't know if it's actually reached to the point where you played actual games, but how have you seen it change kind of using those kind of game-like situations?
Yeah, so I haven't done it, like I don't do it every week, which I should, because the kids honestly do like it and enjoy it. And for the rest of the fall, I should try to incorporate a little bit more. But I think from the kids that I've asked to do it more, I think it just gets them in game mode. And more, once again, we've talked about just an intention and a focus, as to opposed just even within the constraints, just like, hey, you're going to use a long bat and then a short bat, like having those game situations, I think just gets them more engaged. And I think that's what I need to ask them, but I think that's what has gotten them to want to continue to do it. But I have thought, like you said, Robert, about being able to do it on the field now, like, hey, all right, you're going to pick out this situation and boom. All right. Hey, so-and-so go to first and second. This is the count, how many outs they are. But like I was telling Garrett before we started, he was talking about Nick and how Nick's doing some stuff on the field at Georgia Tech. And we do first and thirds every Thursday or every Wednesday at Trinity. It's like, all right, we got first and third every time. And there's one out, and that's how we play. We play like six innings of it, just back and forth. And we do competition on the field with like four teams. And that gets them like keyed in and like, all right, because Murph loves it because he thinks of it more as a base running specific thing. But it just gets them locked in like, all right, first and third. All right, there's a situation. I got a tag up here. I can gain in this situation here. But I like what you said about trying to, I have not been able to incorporate that on the field with those all situations, but something for sure that I would like to do.
I mean, because again, this isn't, you know, when I talk about this stuff, like people are going to be like, this isn't new. And yeah. And I'm not claiming that it is new, but when you start thinking from an ecological perspective, you start realizing how important this stuff is.
Yes.
And then it becomes more of a priority, and what you prioritize gets done more often. And that's, correct. That's why for me personally, I want to, you know, share this ideology with people and to make people more aware of this and to try to help people to think along these lines more frequently, because this goes back to what you were talking about before of when you start doing these different situations, one, there's more variety. So, yeah. So what you're doing isn't as monotonous. And this is that thing of like, now guys aren't just swinging to swing.
Yep.
Now there's more intention behind it. The complexity rises. Now, obviously, if you need to scale it back to have guys just focus on exit VLO, bat speed, etc., and not worry about where it's going, that's totally fine. But if you only ever live there, I think you're doing a disservice to the players. Like, you, you need to grow beyond that at a certain point. Like it's, part of the reason you scale it back is it's easier, and guys may need to start there. But I think that's the challenge is to now scale it up once guys have reached a certain level of bat speed and exit velo. Now we need to develop you into more of a complete hitter. Like these are the prerequisite tools that you need to have. But at some point we gotta move beyond that. And I think that to me is the other element of taking an ecological approach helps keep things more interesting for players and more engaged. And so I think that's the other part too, is if we're going to help grow the game and get more people interested, meaning players and participants, we have to keep players engaged. And two, it's not only going to, you know, draw more people in, but you're going to have better players as a result. And I think at the end of the day, that's the thing that matters the most.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's why I just have bought in so much with the ecological approach and constraints and just the different things of, hey, keeping the kids locked in and focused. And a lot of times, like I've seen, like the kids want more. It's not just like, oh, it just feels like it's worked. Like the kids want more because they see what's happening and how they're growing. And it's still fun for them. It's not like, oh man, I got to do this again. So.
And I suppose this kind of leads into a little bit to, you know, styles of learning. And do you have, I can't remember, do you have a background in education as well too, Julian, right?
Yeah. So I've subbed for the past like two, almost 3 years now, at Trinity and, around in the county as well.
And so like, I know we were having a conversation before about like kind of the education system and learning, and how do you see that translating to, you know, the players that you're interacting with and developing players?
Yeah. So yeah, we talked about this because Steve Johnson always talks about, like Ignatian talks about just flow, and he teaches, mm-hmm, I think he's like AP something. I don't even want to guess.
He's got to be, I mean, the only thing I can understand him being is a social studies teacher, because there's no, at least in Minnesota, there was no econ teaching degree. You're either social studies or math. So he's one of the two. He's either a social studies teacher or a math teacher.
I want to say social studies then. So like him and Kyle Wagner, two guys that he also teaches that are huge, just like with the learning side of it on Twitter, which I've subbed and been in the classroom for a while, but I don't have like an education background, or have been like in a classroom like day in and day out. So I've just learned a lot from them. But the biggest thing, you nailed it, talking about flow, and just like Steve always talks about how in class, there's like no flow from class to class. The kids going from math to econ, they're going to PE and then science. And like the kids are, they seem like they never want to be in class. And that's what I see when I sub. The kids are like, oh, we got to sub today. Heck yeah, man. Like we don't got to do any work. And that's why I love baseball. Going back to the ecological and into the constraints and just allowing them to fail. Cause like with the school system is like, oh, you failed, you're going to redo this class or you're going to stay back another year. And with baseball, I was like, hey, we want you to fail. It's okay. Cause if you don't fail, then not that you're not going to learn, but it's going to be more difficult for you to learn and make adjustments. So I've talked to one of my kids before about it. I'm like, man, like how is it in school? Like going from this class to this class to this class. And he's like, yeah, like it stinks. Like there is no flow. Like it's just like, I'm going from learning about George Washington to going to work on math problems. And it's just like, there's no, from this to this to this subject, it's like nothing is smooth transition. There's not that flow. So that's why with my cage environments, I try to make it have that flow of, all right, everything we're doing has a holistic approach to the game. Like you working on your timing and your barrel accuracy and mixed BP is all flow into you hitting on the field in like about 10 minutes. That's just what I just see in Lake Ignatian. Steve, he talks a lot about teacher king, which he used to talk about all the time, and how like as teachers, they just want to, and I sub, so I can say me as well, we just want to always be in control. And that happens in baseball too. Like, all right, I'm the coach. We're doing it my way or the highway. Like, this is what you have to do, and you have to do it my way, and you're not going to learn. And I'm right about everything, and you don't know what you're talking about because you're a high schooler. It's like, man, like there's like nothing there. Like, how is these kids going to learn and grow? And eventually as they get out of high school one day. So it's just, my wife teaches, and just seeing how things are at times, it's like, man, like, it's either get an A or pass the class, or if you fail, then you're dumb. And it's like, shouldn't be that way. Like, I wasn't the best at school, and me getting this far now in baseball has been because I've failed and I've learned, and I didn't learn when I was in high school. Like, it's been gradual, and it's hasn't been linear whatsoever.
Go for it, Robert.
Then it obviously the biggest issue is right now is kids are basically trained to succeed more than they fail. And a lot of that deals with the school system, unfortunately. But can there be a way, or can we train kids' minds on the baseball side of it to say, hey, you don't have to be 70% or better in this case. You know, you don't have to be passing or better. Can we kind of approach that? Because I think a big issue we see right now is kids who don't want to do it because they keep failing. And they're like, yeah. Oh, yeah, if I fail enough times, I can't do it. I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm out. So is there a way, or can there be a way, or kind of an environment where, hey, we want you to fail, and you should be all right with that?
On the baseball side of it?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for sure there's a way. I think it just comes down to ourselves as coaches, I think, and our pride and ego. Just like, well, if my kids aren't doing well, then, well, I must suck as a coach. Or if my kids are failing this much, then it's because of me, and I don't want to look bad around people. So I think, first of all, it comes from us as coaches, just like kind of kicking our ego and pride down. And then telling our kids, like, hey, like, I am truthfully saying this, like, we want you guys to fail. Like, it is okay. Like, we are giving you the keys here, fail. Like, it's okay. And you guys in that, learn, like, be focused, have some intention, like, all right, what is this failure teaching me at this point in time? Like, it's not just fail, oh, I suck. It's like, no, like, hey, you failed, and what did you notice from your failure? It's just what I notice with our kids, like, allowing them, and like, they know, like, they get frustrated, and it's good to see their frustration, because they know that they can be doing better and will do better. And then they make the adjustments, and it's not just like, oh, I suck, and just throw their bats and get out of the cage and throwing a pity party for themselves. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important to say too, that I think the intention is not necessarily to have guys fail, but just understanding that part of the learning process include, like, the failure will come from trying to challenge yourself and trying to grow. Like, part of what happens of you learning and growing is you need to explore the edges. And in order to figure out, you know, the best way of doing things means you're going to have to do a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
And part of that trial and error is error. So that's just going to be part of that process of you figuring out how to become the best version of yourself. And two, also, we want you to become robust, adjustable, resilient, you know, masterful. And in order to become masterful, sometimes there are lessons or mistakes and lessons learned from those mistakes, or even overcoming something in not the most perfect technical way, but it's still finding a way to find a functional way to, or rather a satisfactory solution, to whatever task you have in front of you. And that's the thing too about this game that I, you know, about baseball that I really like and love about it, is that, you know, it's a good analogy to life, and it's a safe, I mean, this is what all games are for in a way, is to create a place where you can make mistakes and it's not catastrophic, you know? And so, you know, it kind of teach, it becomes a way where you can kind of take the lessons and the mentality that you learn from baseball into the rest of life. And that's the thing, is I think we want to help our players become mentally tough.
Yeah.
And not, you know, when something doesn't go their way, or they, because that's the other thing about the game that I think we have to help players understand, especially if they're, you know, in the starting lineup and they're going to be in there for, you know, multiple at bats, like, okay, your first at bat didn't go the way you wanted it, but how are you going to do the next time you get up? Cause you're going to get another chance. And I mean, I think that's the thing, even for guys who, you know, just pinch hit, like just understanding or not in the lineup currently, hey, you're going to get your chance. And so are you preparing in such a way that when you get your chance, that you're going to make the most of that chance? So Weston, Grimer, he's currently the pitching coach at Hamlin. I apologize, Weston, if I butchered, I probably most definitely butchered your last name. But so he interviewed more recently for a job position, and he didn't get it. And he talked about you know, a quote or something that his dad had said related to the Abe Lincoln quote of, you know, I will spend, if I have 6 hours to chop down a tree, I will sharpen the axe for 4 hours and chop the tree down for two. And so his mentality after finding out he didn't get the job was time to go back to grinding the axe and sharpening the axe. And to me, that is a resilient mindset. And so this goes back to that mental side of the game again. Like, we want to help give our players the most robust mindset to help them deal with any situation that they find in front of them.
Yeah, you nailed it, especially being around high schoolers and the failure aspect of it, and you nailed it. It's what we try to incorporate all the time and bring up to them is, hey, baseball, like, especially with these high schoolers, like, you might finish, baseball might be your last time here in high school, so how are we going to get you ready for the real world? As Lord willing, we help you grow into young men once you graduate. It's like, hey, when you fail, how are you going to adjust? Are you going to throw a pity party? Are you going to point fingers? Like, what's the failure going to teach you? Like, how are you going to respond with that failure? And just reminding them as well, and me too as a coach, and Garrett, you and I talked about it, how my identity is not in this. Like, hey, you failed, and it's okay. Like, you play baseball, but you are not a baseball player. Like, I'm not Julian the coach. I am Julian. I'm Julian Gonzalez. That's who I am. And so many times we get caught up with our identity in what we do. And it's just something that we do. It's not who I am. Another thing with the high schoolers, with the failure, I think, is they get scared to fail around their friends too. It's like, oh man, like, I don't want to fail around my friends. They're going to think I suck, or they're going to make fun of me, or whatever it is. So just being scared to fail, and especially being in the travel ball world, being scared to fail now because of your parents or because of perfect game. And that's a whole different rabbit hole that I can go down and just be like, oh, am I going to be ranked this high, or this and this and this or another in colleges? And there's just so much with the failure aspect of it on the negative side that they just always look at instead of long game.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the point right there, is that how do we keep things in perspective? And, you know, because oftentimes the negative side of things is very easy for us to latch on to that. But how do we see a way through the negativity to, you know, where we want to go, to success, to, I don't like the word optimistic or positive, but, you know, to something optimistic or more positive.
Yeah.
Because I think that's really what we really want to help players understand, is how do we get through that. But one of the things that I wanted to kind of dive deeper into is you talking about the travel ball scene, and two, I think it's really this is actually another good tangent. But so I want to start with the travel ball deal, because I think it's a good example to helping players understand how to handle adversity.
Yeah.
And just pressure too. So what are some of the things that you have seen there as far as like the struggles of players in their quest to play beyond high school that they often struggle with within the travel ball environment?
The biggest thing that they struggle with as a whole, and like over the summer, I coached a 13U team, they're 14U now, and they're really good. Now I got a 15U team, but the biggest thing that they struggle with is just, how do I word it? Like they're always caught up with how other people view them is what they struggle with. So perfect game, if you guys know it well, like every tournament they have the top performers, and like after every game they're like, hey, I'm hitting this much and I got this and this and like I'm top 10 or whatever. And like times where kids would get on base and they were like, hey, was that a hit or was that an error? And they're just so focused on the then and now and the results of it. So that's one reason I really, really do not like, hate's a strong word I always say, but why I do not like perfect game is just how much focus they have on the now. Like they make it to where, and it might not be their purpose behind it, but they make it seem like you have to be good now. And that's all the kids see is, oh, am I going to win the MVP of this tournament? When I go to a showcase, am I going to be ranked a 9? Where am I going to be ranked in my class as a shortstop? And it's just so broken, that system, in my opinion, because now there's no room for growth. Like as a 14-year-old, if you're not top 10 or going to PG select, then you're not any good, which is just a lie for sure. And I bring up how this past year, the Yankees first round pick, don't remember his name, but he's a shortstop at Eastern Illinois, I believe. And I looked him up, and at a high school, he was like the 29th or 30th best shortstop in Kentucky, like not even in his class, but in Kentucky. And I was like, yeah, look at where he ended up. He went to college, developed for 3 years, and the dude signed for $1 million. So it's like, if you guys are caught up with the now of being the number one best shortstop in your class, then you're going to be fine with that and maybe not work harder, just be content with that instead of playing out the long game and not just being content with the short game right now and be like, oh man, PG's got me ranked with this. So they just get very caught up with that. And I try to remind them so much like, hey, you guys are freshmen. Hey, you guys are eighth graders. Like you have so much more baseball left. Like don't worry about this stuff. And it's easier said than done when I tell them that, because I know the next, when we're done talking, they go on their phone and look at it again. But yeah, that's one of the pet peeves with travel ball for me and with perfect games specifically.
What, and that kind of plays with, you know, the notion of like, how do we give people a way through some of the negativity that's out there? And I think one of the things that, and through all the stories that you just told, it's about narrative. What is the narrative and what is the story being told to help players navigate through this, and reminding players of these other stories of somebody getting picked late or kind of getting discovered late and maybe not going to, you know, the most prestigious Division I school out there or getting drafted right out of high school. These players through these other less well-traveled routes have still made it to the major league level,
yeah,
you know, and played on the biggest stage and been highly successful. And I think that's an important story to tell people is, you know, kind of the story of the underdog, essentially. I mean, it is that narrative. And I think that is a very compelling narrative if you're able to kind of craft that for players. And I think that is what also distinguishes really great coaches from, you know, all the rest of us, I guess, you know, is those coaches who are able to craft really good narratives for players that helps them to work hard, that helps them to, you know, make changes both on the field and off the field. And I think narrative is such a powerful thing, especially if we start getting into things like culture, team culture and stuff like that. I mean, I think this is one of the other elements that I think also really shapes the environment in which the player develops in.
Yeah.
And I think we as coaches have the ability to help facilitate or influence that environment by the narratives that we shape and share with our athletes.
Yeah, 100%. That's why just the impact we have as coaches, like you nailed it, like we can be a-holes or we can love them well and encourage them well. Like if we tell them, hey, you suck and this, 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 or another, like All right. Next thing you know, they might be done with baseball and quit because of you as a coach. Or you can encourage them well, even if they don't end up playing college baseball one day. But now, hopefully, you loving them well and caring for them well, building that culture, you've helped them become a better person and help them become grow into a man.
Yeah. So, Julian, usually how we like to wrap is ask for any resources that you would highly recommend people check out. And then where can people find you and connect with you?
Yeah. Resources. I mean, shout out to you guys. It's been super dope having to be able to listen to you guys. And I was talking to you, Garrett, when we talked last time about how I love how long your podcasts are, honestly, because just sometimes when I listen to some baseball specific ones or whatever they may be, and they're too short, then it's like, man, I feel like they could have been more. Or I wanted to hear more. I understand everybody has time commitments and stuff, but with you guys, like especially when you guys have Caleb all the time, shout out to Caleb Abney, one of the homies. I mean, you guys talk for at least an hour and a half, 2 hours, and it's just fantastic. Like driving to work, always playing it, just learning so much. So for sure, you guys. Book-wise, I like on the mental side, talked about the mental keys to hitting. The Inner Game of Tennis is fantastic. Love that one. There's so much, which could have gone down another rabbit hole, just talking about self one and self two. Currently, I'm reading The Way of Baseball by Sean Green, Finding Stillness at 95 miles an hour. That one's been really, really solid read just on his routine and how he went from killing it his rookie season with the Blue Jays to trying to live up to the stats and everything. So that's been a good read. Podcast wise, other podcasts that I've been to, Chad's been putting out some of his older stuff. Chad Longworth, I've been enjoying that one. Coach Your Brains Out. I think they're volleyball guys, I want to say, but they've had your guys, Sean and
Tyler.
And Tyler on there. That's been a good one. The Talent Equation is a good one, podcast wise. Finding Mastery has been a good one. And then recently, I feel like I've been listening to a lot of stuff outside of baseball. So like those last few, listening to other coaches, soccer, volleyball, basketball, whatever it is, have been really good ones. And then shout out to Rob Gray with his podcast and his new book. Just got it. I've only read like the preface of it, but yeah, those are really good resources that have helped me as a coach, and helped me learn and ecological and constraints led. And then some people that have helped me as well, you, Garrett, Tim Gibbons, Jonathan Murphy, who's the head coach at Trinity, Benny Craig, Feel Good Hitting, who I said, Caleb Abney, follow those guys on social media. Like they are fantastic. And then you guys can find me on Twitter. I'm only on Twitter, ABR Hitting, and ABR stands for Always Be Ready. But it's ABR Hitting on Twitter.
Love that. All right. Well, thanks again for coming on. It's been great.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you guys.
Yep. Thank you for the kind words.
Yes.